This is the sixth in a series of Australia Remembers recordings. This one is being made with Mr. Doug Smith of Sladen Street in Cranbourne, and the recording was made on the 25th of August 1995.
It's all go, is it?
Yeah.
Well, shall I talk to you about the farming in those days?
Yeah.
Well, when I went home in 1932, farming, of course, was very much different to what it is now. It wasn't mechanised at all in any way. It was all done by horses. There were some tractors about, but very few. When I first went home, we were milking cows. They were all milked by hand. From memory, I think we employed four men at the time, and we milked 140 cows by hand.
And where was your property?
The property was at the very end of Thompson Road on the Cadinia Creek. Our main fodder for the animals was arrived at by growing oat and hay and maize, which we chaffed up and fed to the animals in bales. We also, of course, used a lot of pollard and bran, which was mixed in with their feed. Some short time after that, we commenced for the first time ever making grass hay. And in making the grass hay, it was we used horses again in a mower, which cut the hay. We then raked with a hay rake, and we used what they called a sweep to bring the hay into a stack, and we stacked the hay in stacks out in the paddock. Later on, we had balers, which you took into the paddock, and then again you went through the procedure of cutting the hay, using a sweep to bring it up to the baler, and it had to be forked into the baler. Of course, that's very much different today's methods, whereby tractors are used and the hay baler just drives around the paddock and picks the grass up and bales it as it goes. And then, of course, the bales are stacked in sheds, which keeps them out of the weather. Now, where do we go from there?
And were you working on the property right through till 1939?
Yes, I was on the property until 1939. In 1939, my wife and I got married, and we moved onto a property of our own down at Turin.
What was Turin like?
Turin in those days, of course, was a little small fishing village. There were a number of fishermen there who earned their living as professional fishermen. Not only did they catch fish, but they also took parties out and fishing. It was a typical little fishing village. My wife and I were married in February 1939, and war broke out, I think from memory, about September the same year. Not sure of that date. On the farm at Turin, that was where I first purchased my purchased a tractor, and thereafter did much of the work with the tractor rather than the horses.
Where was your property at Turin?
The property at Turin was on Lyons Road. It was on the corner of Lyons Road and the highway, South Gippsland Highway. It was about, somewhere about 530 acres on that property. We raised fat lambs and we had some cattle and raised vealers.
And were you working on that right through the war?
Yes, I worked on that right through the war. I remember for a couple of years we couldn't get shearers and I had to shear the sheep myself, which was a bit of an innovation for me. however, we survived.
One of the things that interests me is how Western thought was seen through the war. Some people thought that there might have been, you know, it might have been a way of a Japanese attack or something like that. And you were right down there.
Well, I suppose we always realised that it could happen, but I don't really think that, I certainly didn't expect it to happen. I don't think most of the local people really expected it to happen, although it was in the back of our minds as a possibility. I think we probably felt that Westernport was, with its shoals and channels and so forth, would be perhaps a little difficult for them to come close. And if they did come close, what were they going to do? Fire a few shells on... We're talking now about submarines or... well, as far as submarines were concerned, what could they do? I mean, they can fire a few shells on a few farmhouses. That wouldn't achieve very much. And I thought if the Navy came, if the Japanese Navy came out here, I'd hope that we'd have known long before they got there.
Was it patrols? Were there, like, local militia or patrols?
No, I don't think it was any patrols, not as I know of. There was a sort of a local militia here, the Home Guard, as it was called. That was formed here in Cranbourne. And that was reasonably active through the war, but I don't remember any patrols around the bay or anything like that.
And what did the Cranbourne militia do?
Looking back now, I really don't know. I can't remember. They had plenty of meetings, of course. Sometimes it only seems like yesterday, but sometimes it seems a long while ago. There was, of course, a large military camp here at Cranbourne during the war.
Where was that?
Beg your
pardon?
It was largely up on the racecourse.
For Australian soldiers?
Oh, yes. No Australian soldiers. Somewhere just before the war, some of the locals had formed a golf club. And they had cleared a lot of tea tree off what was the recreation reserve and race course, and formed a club on the, formed a golf links on the race course. But of course that all closed down when the war started.
What did that look like? I mean, what sort of activities?
Well, it was the normal military camp, and they conducted their exercises and so forth. Because apart from the actual recreation area enclosed by the race course or the racetrack, there's a large area alongside of that which was all government land, all belonged to the Commonwealth Government. And so they had their manoeuvres out in the scrub and so forth out there. As I remember it, it was there almost till the end of the war. I might be wrong in that, but I think they were there almost to the end of the war from memory.
And was that when people enlisted, that they were trained there? Or?
No, they can, no. They enlisted probably, most of the people from here would have enlisted in Melbourne. When they were, the troops that came here had been allotted to their various regiments and battalions and so forth, and then came here. They certainly weren't Cranbourne people. I don't know, I can't ever actually remember any of the Cranbourne boys being here in the camp here. They may have, but I don't remember any of them.
So it was basically an army camp.
Oh yes, basically an army camp. Mm.
Was your produce controlled at all during the war? What they wanted you to grow, or where to sell it, or that sort of thing?
No, it was. No, what we grew was not under any restrictions. We reared fat lambs, and they were sold in the open market at Newmarket. The same with the cattle. The same thing applied. I can remember after the war, one of the things that we grew was some peas for seed. You know, there was a shortage of pea seed at the time, and the Department of Agriculture were looking for growers to grow pea seed. And I can remember our next door neighbour and myself, we decided we'd plant some seeds for some of these. We'd grow pea seed for the department, and they supplied us with the seed. And it was an extremely dry year, and we took a great deal of trouble in looking after this crop of peas. And as I remember it, at the time we were to get a pound a bushel for the pea seed when it was harvested. And the department came round and said, well, if you haven't got any particular bacteria in the seed, you get another 2 shillings a bushel. And I thought, that's pretty good, so we didn't have any of that bacteria, so that made it 22 shillings a bushel. And then later on they came round and said, if you like to rogue the peas, that is, you have to walk up and down the rows to make sure there's no rogue variety of pea growing. If you like to do that, it's another 2 shillings a bushel. And because we took so much trouble with our preparing the ground and looking after the ground after the peas had been planted, we were one of the few people in the district that had a crop of peas. And it was to be harvested by a neighbour who had a lend-lease machine for doing that. And after we'd cut the peas, when they were ripe, we cut the peas and put them in windrows and notified him that harvest and they were ready to harvest, and he came down with a harvester, but they were just not quite dry enough. And 2 or 3 days went by and the peas were still not quite dry enough to harvest, and it came a particular weekend and they still wouldn't harvest. On the Monday they wouldn't harvest, and on the Monday evening I remember going to a local fire brigade meeting, and we had 5 inches of rain. And the peas were all buried in mud, so we never got any peas after all that. Not a single one.
What's your main recollections of this area through the war?
Of course, one of the things I remember was petrol rationing. I'm not sure now how many gallons a month we got, something like 4 or 6 gallons a month. A petrol, which didn't go very far. Also, of course, if you needed petrol for any particular purpose, you could apply for it and get a special grant. And the people who controlled the petrol ads seemed to have funny ideas. I can remember on one occasion I wanted to shear the sheep, and I wanted some petrol because the machine was driven by a petrol engine. And when I applied, I thought, well, they'll knock me back, so I better ask for twice as much as I need. And lo and behold, they granted me the whole amount. And on other occasions, when I asked for the right amount, they cut it in half. I can remember somewhere, this would be about 46 or 47 after the war, when petrol rationing was still imposed, and I wanted to go and have a look at a property. I'd sold the property at Turin, and I wanted to go and have a look at a property in New South Wales. So I called at the rationing board and told them I was on my way to have a look at a property in New South Wales and I needed some petrol to get there. And they said, oh, well, make your application and we'll you'll have the petrols in a couple of days. And I said, no, I'm on my way there now. So there was a bit of a consultation, and they came back and said, oh, look, you can have it by tomorrow. And I said, but I'm on my way there now. I'm halfway there. I'm in Melbourne. I'm on my way. And so finally, after another consultation, they came back and said, well, come back in half an hour, which I did. I went to look at the property, and I wasn't impressed with it. And later on, I wanted to have another look at another property, so I applied again for petrol to go and have a look at it. And they told me that they didn't give petrol for such purposes. And when I said, well, I'd had it once before, they said, oh, well, that's different. So I received a ration to go the second time to have a look at a property. In 1950, we built our first, well, not our first home, we built the home that we're in now. And in those days, all building material was restricted, and you had to apply for a permit first of all to build a house, not just with the Shire Council, but with an organisation, I've forgotten their name, in Melbourne. And you're not allowed to build more than, I think from memory, it was 12 squares. I did my best to find a good reason why I could build it a bit larger, and ultimately I got a permit for 15 squares. Lots of things were extremely hard to get. One was cement. I had two chimneys to build, and I applied for the cement and was having so much trouble to get a permit for half a dozen bags of cement that finally I was informed of where I could buy some in Albury, and so I took off for Albury in a small truck and came home with six or seven bags of cement to build the two chimneys. There was really a black market in a lot of the goods necessary to build a house in those days. I had contact with one particular person who had a small timber yard, and amongst other things he sold flush panel doors. Well, all the flush panel doors at that time all came from Queensland, and they used to come down here in big semi trailers, and the Housing Commission used to seize them as fast as they came down and claim the lot, so the private builder couldn't get any. But I remember this fellow, somehow or the other, he got a semi-trailer load, and he immediately had to disperse of them and get rid of them, and all his friends had flush panel doors stacked in their sheds or their houses all around his area. Because in due course the people from the Housing Commission came down and said, you've got some doors. No, I haven't, he said. And they, of course, had a look, but they couldn't find any. And he sold them by going at night, out at night with the utility and picking some of them up from some of his friends' places and then delivering them onto the job.
So
we came here to live in Cranbourne. We actually moved into Cranbourne about 1947. And then we built...
What was Cranbourne like?
What was Cranbourne like then? It was a small country town. There was a single-lane pavement highway down the centre of the town. Large pine trees growing at the side of that. A typical little country town. I think there would probably be about 500 or 600 inhabitants at that time. it wasn't probably till somewhere in the early 50s that the town really started to grow. In those days, subdivisions didn't have to have the streets made. When I say made, they didn't have to be bitumenised. There was no curbing and channelling, there was no sewerage, and a lot of Cranbourne is built on black volcanic clay. And when the first quite large subdivisions took place and started to build houses here, the streets were terrible. In the winter time they were muddy, and the channels at the side of the road were full of stagnant water. septic tanks didn't work properly because the ground was non-absorbent, and it was a very hard time for a lot of people. I think mainly we had a lot of young people who came here because the land was cheap. We had a lot of people who came here from countries overseas. A lot of Dutch people came here at that time, young Dutch people. And they bought blocks of land, and they, most of them, well, quite a lot of them, built their houses out of wages. It was a very difficult time for them. Ultimately, of course, we now have sewerage and the streets are all made, and it's quite a reasonable town now. I'm not sure what the population of Cranbourne is now, but certainly a lot more than the original 500 or 600. Beg your pardon?
What were
the main businesses here? Well, we had a store and a baker and a butcher, the normal things that you find in a country town. As for industry, I think the only industry in the town was a little industry that we had, which was manufacturing joinery. And that was in the main street where the State Savings Bank is now. Yes, we started that business. We were in a rented building. It was an old tin shed, which had been used at some time as a grain store. And we used that for 3 or 4 years, and then we bought some land down, further down in the main street, between Lyle Street and Stall Street, which of course is now all shops. The post office, Cranbourne Post Office, was there for quite a few years. There's part of the post office still there. I think they sort the mail there now. That was, we bought that land and put a building up on it and started to, took our business down there. And we remained down there until 1974, when we sold the land and the building. And we then moved up onto some land which we'd purchased alongside the RSL on the South Gippsland Highway. And we constructed another building up there where we manufactured joinery and started a timber yard selling building supplies. We sold out and I retired in 1987, and it's now owned and run by Harding's Hardware.
And what was it?
When we were running it, it was called Smith and Jolly. When the business first started, I had a partner, a Mr. Tom Jolly, and later on his brother came into the business, Norman Jolly. And then, I'm not quite sure of the date now, but somewhere about 63 or 64, we dissolved the partnership and each went our own separate way. And but I retained the name of the business, Smith and Jolly.
What made you go into that? That's quite a change from farming.
Yes, it is quite a change from farming. I think I went into it because I like doing things with my hands. And I felt I'd like making things out of timber that appealed to me. And when I went into the business, I anticipated that I would be helping to make things out of timber, but it really never got round to that. I found I had a full-time job buying material and pricing jobs and keeping the books and so forth. And the business grew quite rapidly because there was a great shortage of joinery when we first started in the business, and we didn't really have to look for customers. Well, when we first started our business, we were making things like windows and doors, glass doors, and kitchen cupboards and cupboards. That was our main part of our business in those days. In latter years, we got away from that sort of thing. We still did some of it, but not a great deal. We manufactured things like science laboratory benches and specialised joinery, because there was certainly not nearly as much competition in that. But in a few staircases, but we made as few windows and as we could possibly manage. We didn't want to make windows because that was in the 70s. There was plenty of people making windows and the price cutting was terrible. So we moved away from that into other joinery lines. Well, when we first started, we were supplying mainly local builders, although we had people coming from various suburbs of Melbourne because somebody would tell them that we were making joinery and they'd come out in the hope that we would make it for them. People were waiting months and months and months to get their windows so that they could get a building constructed, and because there was such a shortage of windows at that time. For the latter part of our existence, we supplied most of our joinery went to clients in Melbourne, and from there it went to various places. Some of it went up the country. We supplied a lot of joinery that went into Melbourne, into the city proper, and but some of it went away up into the country. Some went to some went down to Warrnambool on one occasion. Well, it was mainly hardwood, although...
Red gum? No,
we didn't use too much red gum. It was mainly hardwood. Sometimes, of course, special timbers would be called for. It might be furniture timbers. We used things like Queensland maple and black bean and Johnson River hardwood. On occasion we've used some imported timbers like Cuban mahogany or whatever was specified, but mainly I'd say hardwood. We used some island timbers, which were an island cowrie. Went under various names, but it was a type of cowrie and came from the islands. During the last 10 years, we didn't really make any joinery. We leased the joinery business and just concentrated on selling building supplies, timber and hardwood and hardware, and the things that go into a house, and apart from the joinery.
So you have to see the changes through this area?
Oh yes, I've seen the changes. I've seen some big changes in Cranbourne, of course. When my first recollections of Cranbourne, the shire offices consisted of... we had a shire engineer, an assistant shire engineer. I think there was one girl helping them in the office. And we had a shire secretary and a young lady who was assisting him. That was the staff of that was the indoor staff of the shire offices in those days. The shire engineer was the health inspector, he was the building supervisor as well as the shire engineer. A man called Mr. Harry Cockcroft, who after he retired went to live in Berwick, and he only died about 2 years ago or even less than that. He had a very varied job when he was in Cranbourne, but he also managed it very capably. Was an extremely well-liked person. He lived in a house which is now in the middle of Cranbourne, and he had from memory, I think he had something like 100 acres around him which he ran cattle as well. And his was the first subdivision, big subdivision anyway, in Cranbourne. That was the start of the subdivision in Cranbourne. There was a street of houses built. Some builder came along and built a street of houses. They were weatherboard houses. They were around about, land and house, from memory, was around about 4,000 or 5,000 pounds, which would be $8,000 or $10,000. And I can remember thinking at the time, how will the people ever pay for that? Of course, with inflation, it became a joke. I mean, they had no trouble to pay for it. No, I was never on the council. I was on various bodies around the town at various times. I was a member of the swimming pool committee, which raised money here for a heated swimming pool. I was a member of the turf club committee. I was a member of the recreation reserve committee. I was a member of the sewerage board when it was first formed and before it was taken over by the council. I was a member of the high school council for a few years. I've got to think of all the things that I was on. I was on a few.